Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Emily Reddy. The first season of the podcast Serial and the story of Adnan Syed caught fire. The story of Syed's conviction for the murder of his girlfriend led many to ask the podcast's host, Sarah Koenig, whether the justice system was broken. In season three of Serial, she tackles that question. Today's episode is from the Democracy Works podcast, a collaboration between WPSU and the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. Michael Berkman, director of the McCourtney Institute, talked with Koenig about season three of Serial, which takes a look at the criminal justice system through embedding in one courthouse in Cleveland. The interview was recorded on the Penn State campus in front of a live audience.
Sarah, thank you for joining us on Democracy Works.
I am delighted.
And congratulations on such a successful season of Serial. It was a fascinating look at a critical part of our democracy, how we administer justice. What is it about this season, you think, that has so captured people's attention?
I don't know. I mean, I was worried no one was going to listen. I mean, not no one. You know what I mean? Like, I know we have an Serial has an audience that a certain group is going to come along, I think, no matter what, I hope. But I did worry because it was such a different kind of project, and it wasn't one story, and it wasn't one particular sort of hunt for a thing that people would not be into. And it's hard. It's difficult material. It's depressing, some of it. It's hard to know what to do with it once you know it. It sits on you, and you're kind of like, well, so now what? So it's hard. It wasn't an easy thing. So I was really thrilled so many people listened. I think we actually broke a record for us in our first two episodes, like the number of downloads we had. So I was shocked, actually. I don't know. I mean, I think it's because we're geniuses and we're really good at telling stories. So there's that.
Yeah.
I think we tried to do what we know how to do, right? Which is to make it narrative as we could, and to introduce difficult concepts kind of slowly and not overload you with information. And I also think it's a topic. It's very all here, right?
Yeah.
So it's become a topic that people are talking about and caring about in the last however many years, and that's personally a thrill to me.
Yeah.
But I think that helped, like the timing of it helped.
Well, so the first season told the story of one case.
Right.
Of Adnan Syed.
Mm-hmm.
And so his case, of course, is very rare for a criminal case.
Right.
It went to trial. He had a well-paid attorney. He himself didn't have a criminal record. The trial lasted for weeks and on and on. So I have a two-part question. You could take both parts, one part, however you want to do it. But what did you learn from that case and season that informed this third season? And what were you hoping to do with this third season that you could not do with the first season? Or the second season, which was also one case.
So the thing that I think we all found interesting about the Adnan Syed case was that after I did a ton of reporting on it, I was like, something's not right here. Something is wrong with this case. And I don't think the crime happened the way that the state said that it did.
Mm-hmm.
And that story is what got a 17-year-old kid convicted and sent to prison for the rest of his life. So it felt like something's off here. And yet when we looked at it, and we looked at sort of how the investigation went, how the prosecution went, how the defense went, the judge's role, the jury's role, there wasn't a bad guy. You know, there wasn't like some coked up, you know, defense attorney who like, you know, conked out at the table, or, you know, there was no like evidence that somebody had been paid off, or, you know, there was no like obvious like, aha, I see the problem, I see the broken link, I see why this thing isn't quite right. It felt like everybody is kind of doing their job at a perfectly okay level for how our system works, actually. And yet, this is the outcome, this very imperfect thing. And so that was a thing that stayed with us, of like, wait, is this just like how our system goes?
But that led you to want to look at the system as a whole.
Yeah, yeah. So it felt like, and also it did feel like a lot of people afterward were like, well, what does this mean about the whole system? Like, can you extrapolate? And it felt like, well, no, you can't extrapolate off of one case that, as you point out, is pretty extraordinary. Mm-hmm. So it really did feel like, well, let's just go look and see the ordinary stuff. Just like what is the baseline functionality of our system in a very kind of day-to-day mundane way, honestly. Like treat it as an office. Like just treat the courthouse like an office and see how it works.
So you chose Cleveland, and in some sense, Cleveland chose you because they allowed you to record.
Yes,
and a lot
that
of other cities
lot.
Would it. You couldn't do that in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
And you had this remarkable interview with a guy by the name of Steve Loomis, right? Who was the head of the police union. And it was one of those interviews where it had me thinking, does he know he's actually being taped?
Right?
And I guess you cut out some of the most racist stuff. From what I've read, there were parts of what he said that you didn't even put into the... Am I incorrect on that?
You're not incorrect on that.
So maybe fill us in on Officer Loomis for people that don't really know exactly what it is I'm talking about. And I'm just curious just what you made of all this. I mean, he was elected, wasn't he, by the other police officers?
Yeah, I mean, and then he got unelected. Like, when we talked to him, he was on his way out.
Did he get unelected?
Well, not because of us.
Okay.
He was already unelected. Yeah. No, I mean, he was like in his last few months in office at that point. You know, he's a little more bombastic and performy, I think, than other police union presidents.
So he was trying to demonstrate just how racist he could be. to impress you?
No, I mean, Steve doesn't think he's racist, okay? Mm-hmm. He does not think he's racist. So he wasn't trying to be. He's just being himself, and that's, you know, he's doesn't hide who he is, which I totally appreciate as a reporter, honestly. But he... you know, his stance, setting the racism aside, which is obviously very disturbing, the other thing that's very disturbing is this kind of lip service to, we are open to reform, yes, we can always get better, and then a total and complete opposition to any practical reform.
Yeah.
Or to any admission that his officers or that officers actually do anything wrong, and that there's anything systemically wrong. So it was just a very typical, I mean, if you read about, for example, what's happening in Baltimore, what's happened in some other, unless you know, Cleveland's under a consent decree, so is Baltimore, so are a lot of places. And it seems like the places where there has been any true successful outcome from those consent decrees, I think Seattle has actually had a pretty good result, if I'm not mistaken. It's where they get buy-in from the police union. And it's hard. It's in a place like Cleveland, it's very hard. It's very old school. It's very like, don't tell me how to do my job. I put my life on the line every day, et cetera. So he's a very colorful character, but he's not atypical of kind of the stance he's taken within the department.
Well, let me, one more question about policing. So we hear a lot about the idea of community policing, where police try to create relationships and partnerships with residents of the community. And tell me if I have this wrong, but Cleveland used community policing, but then it got cut because of budget issues in 2000 or something like that. So do you think community policing would help some of what you saw in Cleveland, and especially I'm thinking about East Cleveland, because really your podcast is really about these two cities, right? You have a couple of episodes in East Cleveland, which struck me as a city that is just almost ungoverned or so poor that it just seems like
it's very neglected.
So I guess I'm curious what you think community policing brings that might be helpful.
I don't know. I don't know enough about it, I guess, to say for sure. I know that there are people who study this stuff who say that is the solution. Police want it. Most police I've spoken to, they want to be doing that kind of policing. They see the value of it, and they think it's valuable, and they don't want to be the people who, in a place like Cleveland, all you do is get in your car and just race from call to call to call to call. And half the time, you're at a call trying to deal with something, and then you get a call for a more major thing, and so you're ripped away. So then that person that you were trying to help is like, there goes my guy, you know. So it's bad for everyone, that kind of place. And so, you know, they want it, and they want, I think, to be able to have real interaction with people and communities. But whether or not, like, I mean, I think it depends how something like that is run and how real the commitment is. And
well, one thing that really struck me in several of these stories is just the lack of trust between residents and community and the police. So there was even one case, if I had this right, where the father of a murdered child who knew who murdered his child would not tell the police who did it.
That's not quite right.
Is that not quite
so
right?
So he would say it stories. All day long.
There are other cases
what
in there,
he
too.
Thought, what he thought, he thought. You know what I mean? Like, well, I don't know for sure. But he said, like, look, the street knows. There's all these people who know.
Okay.
I see this guy all the time. Like, it's clear to me that he was the shooter. and... yeah, there's no, you know, he knew that his neighbors were not going to go to the cops. And he found it very frustrating, obviously, and very upsetting. But he also completely understood it, that it's not a safe thing to do. Ultimately, the good that will come will probably not outweigh the bad. And the government is not for us. It is not here to serve us or protect us. And that attitude, when I first went to Cleveland, I couldn't really understand it, I think, as a like white person of privilege who lives in like, you know, a place where there's not a lot of crime. I was sort of like, really? You would never talk? Like, why not? Like, why wouldn't you? You know, and then by the end of the reporting, I have to say, I was really like, oh, yeah, don't call the cops.
Well, the story in the last two episodes, right, about the, I don't remember his name.
Joshua.
Joshua, yeah. Who was in the juvenile system.
Yes.
And had helped the police.
Yes.
And it was awful for him.
He was sort of tortured for 2.5 years. Yeah.
I mean, it was just remarkable to me. By the end, he was better off in the adult correction system,
right,
just because of how unsafe it had become for him in the juvenile system.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. So that issue of cooperating with law enforcement, you know, AKA snitching, was in some way like the arc of the whole series for us, of just kind of the way that cooperation or lack of cooperation, we were hearing pieces of it in each story, and we're trying to sort of build a bridge that you understand by the time you get to Joshua, like, oh, this is going to be a really bad decision for you to cooperate. And indeed, it turns out to be one.
It was a powerful way to end.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. We're talking with Sarah Koenig, the host of the podcast Serial, which spent season 3 looking at the criminal justice system through the experience at one courthouse in Cleveland.
So let's talk about judges a little bit. You give rich profiles of some different judges, some of whom exhibit behavior that many people probably thought occurred on TV shows, but not really, right? Lecturing defendants about whether or not they should have children and berating them, and in some cases, perceptively recognizing when they were being played or lied to. So Judge Gage was one of the more entertaining and disturbing judges.
Judge Gall. Judge Gall.
Yeah.
He's really typical of that courthouse in Cleveland. He's an Irish guy.
Right,
his dad had been in county politics. He was getting near retirement age, so he was like mid-60s. He'd been on the bench a long time. And in Cleveland, in Ohio, you know, county judges have an extraordinary amount of discretion and latitude. And they really do, I mean, it's sort of like a cliche of the courthouse, but like they really do treat it as their own little kingdom. Mm-hmm. And so he had his style and his way of sort of berating almost every defendant who came before him. And he saw it as like tough love, of like, I'm going to sort of take you by the collar, young person, and try to like shake you around a little bit and talk mm-hmm. some sense into you so you get on the right track. The way it came out was so shocking that I didn't know where to, like, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is A, radio gold, but also just like, I didn't know this was possible. And why is nobody saying anything? Like, am I the only one that's hearing, you know? And the fact is, like, it's just like everybody knew that was his... That was his rep. You steeled yourself before you went in the room. You knew what triggered him.
Yeah, you said the defense attorneys really prepared their clients on.
Yeah,
that,
they right? prepared them.
Sit there and take it.
Yeah, take it. Or sometimes, like in one of the early scene, I think in that episode, he's literally holding his client. He has like a hand on his neck, like the back of his neck, and another one on his thigh, like just kind of like, and it was weird. And we were like, why is he touching him like that? And then it was later, like, you realize like, oh, he's just like, don't move. It's going to be over soon. Just don't say anything. And another typical thing of Judge Gall was he's Democrat, even though in his heart he is a raging conservative Republican, I do believe. But he, but you know, yeah, that's how you get elected in Cuyahoga
right.
County. And so, you know, there's a lot of this, nobody pays attention to judicial races. So you see the Democratic name, it's an Irish name, and you're like, it's vaguely familiar because there's like 10,000 people like mm-hmm. named Gall in the county, and you're like, yeah, that guy, I'm sure he's fine. And so that's how these people get sort of, they stay on the bench forever.
So a lot of what he did, yeah, he berated people, but he was really trafficking in racial stereotypes.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of what he was saying.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious whether you saw this in his decisions, too. So he's using these racial stereotypes. I got the feeling they made you uncomfortable. The defendants just have to sit there and take it. But then does he treat everybody equally in his, when it comes to actually making decisions? Did you detect the
difference? I don't want to be too strident about like, oh, he was nicer to white people. I don't think we did a sort of like scientific enough survey to know that. What I will say is, look, 75% of the defendants in that courthouse are black. So he's dealing with black people a lot more uh-huh. than he's dealing with yeah. white people.
So yeah. This judge in particular also made extensive use of probation. I mean, one reason these defense attorneys were telling their clients to shut up is that they probably were going to end up with probation, or there was a good chance that they could end
right.
up with probation. I don't
yeah.
want to overstate it, but there was a good chance. So he often put defendants under supervision for years
yeah.
in lieu of jail time. But you also point out that probation's no picnic.
Yeah. It's also a trap. In a
right,
lot of
and
ways.
That it's
yeah.
a trap. Yeah, and I wanted to talk about that a little bit in some different ways. You know, so why is it that you thought that some defendants might have actually preferred jail time to probation, or... You know, or they
yeah.
might have been better off anyway.
Yeah.
They probably weren't thinking.
I mean,
well,
I don't want to
send me to jail.
Yeah, but, I only heard that a couple times. I mean, it wasn't yeah. like I wouldn't say that's the overall like just says anything but probation, because again, like nobody wants to get locked up.
Let me throw
up,
something
but,
else in before you answer. Actually,
right.
it had me also thinking of this idea that you know, innocence is a misdemeanor.
Mm-hmm.
That people are constantly being pled out to these misdemeanors, like the young woman in the bar in the very first
yeah.
episode. Who seemed, I don't know, completely innocent to me anyway, and ends up with this misdemeanor. And as you point out, you know, this just begins a sort of spiral for her of all kinds of stuff
right.
going wrong. And I don't think that's unusual when people are in the system like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, and I think you're seeing, you know, as we're getting in some more progressive prosecutors around the country, you're seeing like that's one of the key things that they are looking at is like, can we please try to, I mean, they're not supposed to be sentencing people, but for all intents and purposes, prosecutors have a huge, huge influence on the sentences people get. And also they can sort of reverse engineer it by determining which charges, right? So one of the things you'll see is them saying, please, you know, let's look at probation and try to like narrow it down, because probation violations are just, I mean, you're half the docket, you feel like, when you're in there, when I was watching, would be a probation violation. And they were, I mean, some of them, I guess, are real. Like, yeah, if you go, like, carjack someone while you're on probation, agreed, that's probably violating your probation. I don't think that's okay. But, like, you know, staying out after curfew, or I, you know, had to go out of state because of somebody's funeral, or I smoked some weed 3 weeks ago, sue me, you know, and then they're having to come back through the thing, and if you piss off the judge, then, like, he can put you back in, and especially someone like Judge Gall, who has a temper, you can end up incarcerated. And so, you know, part of the hugely frustrating thing we saw in Ohio, but I think this is, again, true in lots of parts of the country, there's no data. We don't keep data on this stuff. Nobody is tracking outcomes, say, for when is probation in our jurisdiction, like, when is it proving effective? When are people starting to slide off, you know, and violate more and more? What is a rational amount of probation for a person? Like, what is actually useful? And so, like, yeah, you would just see these kind of like 3 years probation, 5 years probation, and that's basically like, why don't you just handcuff me to your bench now for the next 5 years? Like, that's kind of how it works.
So talking about these more progressive district attorneys had me thinking about Larry Krasner in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Who has argued that, I believe that probation after 1 year is really not actually being that effective. Probation's effective for a year.
He's saying 12 months is kind of like the max we should be
so
thinking
is he
about.
An example of kind of DA?
He's amazing. I don't know if you guys have like followed what he's doing. He's really extraordinary. I read he wrote a memo soon after he was elected. I think it was like a couple months in, and it got leaked maybe about a year ago. And I read it, and I was like, I started reading it, and then like my jaw was just like dropping open. I couldn't believe it. And the stuff that he's doing, it's all super. I mean, that's the other thing that's so upsetting. It's like the thing that is seen as radical, that what he's doing, to me just seems like, right. Why isn't this the norm? You know, but it's so not the norm. So the things that he's doing are like, yes, there's the probation thing. He's told his prosecutors, any amount of marijuana, we are not charging it. Literally any amount of marijuana, we are not charging it. Certain thefts, he's under $500, I think it's like a ticket rather than a misdemeanor. For prostitution charges, we're not gonna charge them. And then it's like, if you have a few of them, we're gonna divert, you know, just divert. There's also just like divert to any kind of pretrial services we can do, or alternate courts or whatever. When we offer pleas, we're going to offer the lowest, the minimum in the range or whatever. Like, that never happens.
Yeah, so it's going to. So and you didn't see anybody like this among the prosecutors.
No. I mean, that's what. There's some. They do want to divert. Like, they're not all monsters or something. Like, they're normal people who are like, yeah, this person's just like addicted to drugs, or like it's family, whatever. Like, they're recognizing the societal issues and the personal issues that are going on there, but they're locked into certain things. Or, so for example, there's a drug court in Cuyahoga County. There are actually two of them. And, you know, if you talk to the judges who run that, they're very compassionate. They take extra training to learn about addiction and best practices. It's a super supportive, very kind of social worky atmosphere. They make personal relationships with the defendants and all these things. And they don't even call them defendants. I think they call them like participants. I don't know. There's like another word for it. It's not like they're not easy to get through, but it is a truly supportive environment. And they do, like the judges I talked to, especially this one judge, she really cares. Like, she cares about these people and she gets to know them. You go in that court, almost everyone participating is white. So then, why is that? So what are we doing, right? So, well, the rules for the drug court are, if you have this on your record, or that on your record, or that on your record, you're not eligible. So like, that's one thing they were trying to start addressing when we were there, of just like, they were kind of recognizing like, oh, all of our graduates of drug court, it's like a 90% white graduation rate in a courthouse that's like 75%. Like, well, this is upside down world, right? So there's a lot of structural things, I'm saying, that the prosecutors can't control. So yes, I think like progressive prosecutors and the focus that we have lately on progressive prosecutors and the big money that's going into these prosecutors' races across the country, like George Soros money is going into it now, it's fantastic. But it is one, granted, very powerful piece, but it is one piece. Mm-hmm. And the system is enormous, and it has many different machines working at once. They do not often interact with each other well or at all. And so I get a little nervous when we start saying, oh, we've figured out how to fix it, just elect a bunch of progressive prosecutors. Well, to me, my fear is, yes, you can elect progressive prosecutors, you also can replace those. You can unelect those same prosecutors. So I would rather see more systemic change.
So there are a lot of students here today, many of whom are probably very troubled by some of what they've learned from you about the criminal justice system or in general.
Sorry.
So so from what you saw, what parts of the system are most in need of new, smart, dedicated people?
Prosecutors' offices. I know, like, I read some story, I think it was in the New Yorker or something, of Larry Krasner. It was just like a scene of him going to some law school somewhere and just trying to recruit, like, lefty kids. I thought it was very nice to be prosecutors, you know, which is like the last thing these kids thought they wanted to do. And he was trying to say, like, be part of the revolution. And that's great. And so I think, yeah, the prosecutor's offices need it. Prisons. I mean, nobody wants to go work in prison. But I have to say, like, the thing that still hurts my heart from Cleveland is the Ohio Department of Youth Services, which was what runs the juvenile facilities in Cleveland. It was really, really, really upsetting, the kind of dead to the world, like, I don't hear you. You know, we did a lot of reporting toward the end of the season about what was happening in Ohio's juvenile prisons. And I just was watching a thing online of, in the Ohio legislature, there was a hearing with the new director of ODYS, which is the government agency that oversees it. And a legislator said, hey, what about what Serial Podcast was saying about all the crazy crap that's going on and the corruption and the danger, and these children are, like, you know, in a crazy house. Mm-hmm. And he completely blew it off. Just completely blew it off. Like, nothing to see. It was just entertainment. We're on it. We know what's going on. They didn't use the statistics we gave them. You know, and it's that kind of thing where, like, if you're not even going to admit there's a problem. Anyway, I'm getting off track. Mm-hmm. But I would say, like, those kinds of agencies that seem to, that I know are so unsexy, but I feel like if you're asking where you can make a difference, yeah, boy, wouldn't it be fantastic to have the smartest, you know, most compassionate, most energetic brains be working on juvenile crime.
Sarah Koenig is the creator of the podcast Serial, which spent season 3 looking at the criminal justice system through the experience at one courthouse in Cleveland. Today's episode was from the Democracy Works podcast, a collaboration between WPSU and the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State. Today's interviewer was Michael Berkman, director of the McCourtney Institute. You can hear more Take Note interviews and more episodes of Democracy Works at wpsu.org/radio. I'm Emily Reddy, WPSU.